do you feel about data? Because we're going to do a lot of it. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Tuesday, today, the 28th of November. Good as always to have you along, everybody. A quick check of data as we get going today on the state of play in this economy. You will see why I'm starting here in just a second, by the way. Inflation, as measured by the Consumer Price Index, sits at 3.2% year on year. Lower than it was, but still higher than the Fed wants it to be. Unemployment is at 3.9%. The economy overall is growing at 4.9% as of the last reading. As I said, more data than I like to throw at you all at once. But the Federal Reserve is keeping track, so you don't have to. Austin Goolsbee is the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago. Austin, welcome back to the program. Good to have you on.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
Let me take you back to your data dog roots, as you talked about the last time you were on this program. I need you to decide on one piece of data you're looking at to foretell the future of this economy and also what you at the Fed might do.
Yikes. I'd say of all the pieces that right now I'm looking at, what's happening to housing inflation is probably the most paramount one.
Okay, why?
As you know, the Fed has, by law, a dual mandate: stabilize prices, maximize employment. Those two goals, we've been doing very well on the job market side, and where we have fallen has been on inflation. So the most critical thing over the near term is that we get inflation down to target. And we have been making a lot of progress on getting the inflation rate down. Services move slower. And so the key component is going to be what happens to housing. And it's been making some progress. It's supposed to make more progress, but that's the forefront. That's not the only thing I'm looking at, but that's probably the most important in the immediate term.
Why do you suppose it has taken the markets so long to take the Fed at its word? You know, I mean, you guys have said forever, and by you guys, of course, I mean Powell and all y'all, we're going to do what it takes. We're going to be data dependent. And yet for a very long time, it seemed like the market kind of didn't believe you. And I wonder why you think that is.
I guess I think two things about that. But the first is, I don't know if I totally agree with the premise. Because if you actually look at market behavior, as opposed to just what people say, inflation expectations, as estimated by the market, even as the inflation rate itself got above 9%, unlike basically all previous inflation episodes in this country, the market expectations of where inflation would be in the future never really went up much higher than the target. So there is a fundamental way in which people did believe in the credibility of the Fed when the Fed said, we will do what is necessary to get the inflation rate down. Now, that's a little different than the part of your question that you're asking, why didn't the market rates reflect what we were saying in our economic projections the rates were going to be? I don't totally know why, except to say there are a lot of other things that happen in the world of rates and economic growth than just what the Fed does.
Thank you for clarifying my question, actually. That was a really good explanation. Let me ask you, though, about market rates, right? If you look at the 10-year now, the 10-year is starting to bake in the fact that you guys are going to start cutting rates really soon. And again, that's not what you're saying out loud.
Yeah. The thing about long rates, the Fed, of course, we directly control the short rates.
Right.
We've been going through this period where the long rates were going up and up. Like when we talked on this program, Kai, in April, the thing that was foremost in our mind was Silicon Valley Bank, credit crunch, might there be a credit contraction or even financial crisis? And that didn't happen. So I think that's the main driver that got longer rates up, is that conditions were more positive than we thought they were going to be.
So let me get it out of the realm of rates and markets and all of this and get it to sort of brass tacks about how people are feeling in this economy, right? The economy is, by almost every objective measure, really, really good, right? It's growing. Joblessness is down. I mean, yes, it's historic lows. It's been lower, but whatever. Unemployment is doing really well, right? Wages are up in comparison to inflation, all of those things. And yet survey after survey after survey says people feel lousy about this economy. And I want to know why.
Look, Kai, you do the numbers every day. Has there ever been a bigger gap in the numbers between feelings and reported? I don't know. This might be the biggest ever. It's not just among consumers. I would say if you look at business sentiment, you see a similar thing. We just had GDP growth that was close to 5%. Mm-hmm. In our business contacts at Chicago Fed, we talked to hundreds of business people around the district. Virtually no one was saying, wow, this is a 5% growth economy that we're experiencing right now. So that remains a bit of a puzzle. The number one job that the central banker faces is you got to be able to look at the data and sniff around and figure out what does it mean. And that means you got to know what data series are most accurate and what data series are leading indicators versus lagging indicators and things like that. And it is the case that we know that sentiment data of this form, A, tends to lag heavily actual events in the economy. B, very public prices, like the price of gasoline or the price in the grocery store, have a very strong impact on people's perceptions of what the inflation rate is or how the economy is doing. And the relationship of sentiment as a predictive variable for consumer spending has largely broken down over the last 10 or 12 years for reasons we partly understand and partly don't. But as a result, I can't really tell you the explanation of why the discrepancy is as big as it is, but I can tell you what we need to see is the actual inflation data getting down to target and the actual employment data. Those are the things that we got to pay attention to.
Right. Last thing, and then I'll let you get back to work. Without asking you to pre-commit, as you are loath to do, about what might be on the table at the next meeting in a couple of weeks, what is your level of concern about overshooting, about keeping rates too high for too long?
Definitely some concern. We just came out of Thanksgiving season, Guy, and Paul Volcker, my old mentor, was a great turkey cook, and he took a lot of pride in cooking his turkey. And the thing, anybody who cooks a turkey knows that you got to pull it out of the oven before it's to the point where you want it to be, because it's going to have residual heat. And if you just keep cooking the thing for too long, they're going to be like, Mommy, why is Uncle Kai's turkey so hard to chew? So we've been in restrictive territory because we've got to get inflation down. That's our sacred vow, and we're going to do it. Once you believe that you are on the path to get inflation to target, then the amount of restrictiveness that you need to apply needs to be less. And it was already in the projections that the median dot in the dot plot was saying rates would, by the end of 24, be down 100 basis points. And, you know, we'll see what it looks like in the next one. At the next meeting, we're gonna have another projection.
Right. Sorry, I said that was the last one. It's not. One more quickie. When you get where you're going, how quickly do you suppose policy response will be made, right? Once we get to 2% and PCE comes out, or CPI, or whichever one you choose to look at, comes out and says, bing, 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 2%, is it like next meeting, boom, do you think?
In a way, it's too hypothetical to answer
that.
That's
fair. That's fair.
But the other part of the job of central bankers, as Paul Volcker used to say, there is no silver lining that is bright enough that he could not think of a dark cloud that could block it out. And part of the job is to think through what are the risks and how will we play it? How will we react? So we meet every 6 weeks precisely so that we don't have to pre-commit how fast we're going to do things. It's going to depend on how the data go.
Austin Goolsbee, he's in charge of the Chicago Fed. Austin, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Kai.
Wall Street today, you know, we'll talk about the bond market in a little bit. Stocks generally up. Details, numbers, you all know the drill. Glancing at my handy-dandy economic calendar, I see we'll get an update on that economic growth figure I mentioned setting up Austin Goolsbee. Tomorrow, the Bureau of Labor Statistics is going to be out with its first revision of third-quarter gross domestic product. And among the line items in that thing getting special attention will be data on corporate profits. During the pandemic, those profits took off, and by the middle of last year, they were running almost half again above their peak from the before times. Since then, though, the corporate profit trajectory has been going the other way. So we asked Marketplace's Justin Ho what that might be telling us about the broader economy.
One reason why corporate profits are down compared to last year is because labor costs are up, says George Perks, macro strategist at Bespoke Investment Group.
That's a combination of wage growth and tight labor markets, really dating back all the way to 2019.
But Perks says the big reason corporate profits are down is because consumer demand is tapering. People aren't getting any more money from pandemic relief programs. They've also burnt through a lot of their savings.
I mean, there's a wide range of different explanations for this, but consumers are much, much less interested in spending at the pace they did earlier in the expansion.
Rising interest rates play a role, too. Bill English is a finance professor at Yale and a former staff member at the Federal Reserve's Board of Governors. He says the central bank's rate hikes haven't only slowed household spending, they've also raised borrowing costs for corporations.
And as a result of their higher interest costs and lower profits, firms are likely to retrench some, so they'll pull back a bit.
And that, English says, is exactly what the Federal Reserve is trying to encourage.
The Fed wants to slow spending, and lower corporate profits will discourage firms from investing as much and expanding their activities as much.
We're already starting to see that play out in certain parts of the economy. Shannon Siri Grine, an economist at Wells Fargo, says the manufacturing and wholesale industries have cut back on equipment, inventory, and other capital expenditures because
your manufacturing and wholesale industries have seen some of the most significant declines in profits, which I think is consistent with what we've seen in the broader economy as well in those sectors.
But even though profits are moderating, they're still higher than they were before the pandemic. After all, plenty of people are still going out and spending. As a result, Grine says corporations generally haven't started cutting back on their biggest expense, labor.
It's sort of like the chicken and the egg, right? Do you have to see the slowdown in demand first, or do you have to see firms starting to lay off their workers?
Grine says if hiring slows down, so will consumer spending, and then so will profits. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
All right, stop me if you've heard this one before. The former co-CEO of Salesforce, a former Secretary of the Treasury, and the once upon a time Chief Technology Officer at Facebook, they all walk into a conference room together and there you go. It's the new interim board of directors for the best known AI company in the world. Not a joke. You might have heard OpenAI's old board with CEO Sam Altman had some beefs. That old board is mostly gone. Altman is still there. Now, OpenAI is technically a nonprofit and has an unusual, shall we say, corporate governance structure. Boards of directors, though, are by law a staple of U.S. corporations. What, though, does a board actually do? Marketplace's Matt Levin is on the Corporate Governance Explainer Desk today.
The origin story for boards of directors dates back to the ye old guilds of medieval England. Blacksmiths and fishmongers and seafaring merchants would elect a council to set industry rules. When those councils met, they sat on a bench, which they called a board. Lumbar support was a luxury reserved for the council leader.
Everybody else sat on the bench next to the table. The chair at the head of the table is under chair. That's how they got the title chair.
Frank Gewirtz is a professor at the University of the Pacific's McGeorge School of Law. With the rise of the first big corporations like the British East India Company, that council evolved into modern boards of directors elected by shareholders.
Its purpose in many ways is to be a democratic institution so that we can say, well, there's somebody elected who's in charge.
The average Fortune 500 company has a board of about 11 members, give or take. For publicly listed companies, stockholders elect the board annually. Private corporations also have boards, often appointed by private investors. Board members typically meet every quarter and get paid hundreds of thousands of dollars. Pretty sweet gig. Yoju Chang is an assistant professor at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business.
We're talking about people in the highest, highest echelons of the business world. Very typical to find people who are CEOs of other major corporations, people that have very high-level executive experience.
Chang says board members have to be available in times of crisis or scandal and help set strategic goals for the organization. But the number one job is basically to make sure the people running the company are doing their jobs.
One of the core responsibilities is hiring and firing the CEO. And as we've seen, that can have huge implications for the direction of an organization.
And that can be pretty awkward because CEOs are often on the boards of these corporations. Law school professor Frank Gewirt says CEOs also have major sway on who sits on the board in the first place.
In terms of kicking out the CEO, that, ironically, is something that boards historically are reticent to do, and the complaint is they don't do it enough.
And even when they do, sometimes the CEO doesn't stay fired. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
Coming up.
So the margins in the chemical industry really came to a screeching halt.
A chain reaction, you might say, in the chemicals supply chain. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 83 points today, 0.25%, 35,416. The NASDAQ lifted 40 points, 0.3%, 14,281. The S&P 500 picked up 4 points, about 0.1%, 45.54. Today is Giving Tuesday, in case somehow you had not heard. It is, of course, a day a lot of nonprofits and charities use to supercharge their donations. The Giving Tuesday Data I'll say this 10 times fast. The Giving Tuesday Data Commons, Giving Tuesday Data Commons, estimates that last year, 37 million adults in the U.S. participated in some way, giving a total of $3.1 billion. Bond prices were up. That means the yield goes down. Thank you, Jay Powell, 4.33%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. It's now been a year, give or take, since ChatGPT was released into the wild. And in that 365 or so days, there's been a lot of both exuberance and hand-wringing about how generative AI tools might change work as we know it, starting with how we get work. A survey from Resume Builder earlier this year found almost half of job seekers are already using ChatGPT to crank out resumes and cover letters, and those that did said they got interviews at a higher rate than those that did not. The trend seems like a win for job candidates, but as is usually the case, there are some trade-offs, as Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino reports.
On a TikTok channel with 30,000 followers and counting, Evan Lutz shares a simple formula he says can help anyone land a high-paying tech job.
I'm going to teach you everything you need to know to start a cybersecurity career in 60 seconds. The first thing that you
need. He also has a newsletter with about 20,000 paying subscribers and an $8,000 boot camp based on his experience jumping from a job teaching high school math to a cybersecurity career in 2019.
What I tell people is if you do this right, you can get a starting salary of $90,000 a year in 90 days.
It starts with building a solid resume and applying to at least 1,000 jobs. Yeah, so automating some of that process is going to be key.
Everybody's trying to make the least impressive thing that they did look the most impressive.
And ChatGPT's tendency to embellish can be handy. It could, for instance, transform a career as a public radio journalist into the perfect qualification for, how about a professional wine and spirits buyer?
Oh, very nice.
Okay, so I've got the job highlights, qualifications, responsibilities. I'm going to copy and paste these.
Copy the entire thing, paste it in ChatGPT, say, give me tips on how to specifically get this job.
All right. Given the job description you provided, here's how you can tailor your application and interview preparation based on your journalism background.
Beautiful.
One, experience in high-pressure environments. Yes. Showcase your experience in journalism where you worked under tight deadlines, handled pressure, and delivered high-quality work. This is super helpful.
So the next step would be write me a resume that would maximize my chances of getting an interview for this job.
But this strategy can definitely backfire. Fatima Mirza is a career coach who sometimes uses ChatGPT with clients. But when she was hiring for a customer service position for her company Career Tuners, she says some AI users were easy to pick out.
Because they accidentally copy their prompts into the answers too.
Including one exchange that turned to insults.
He called ChatGPT stupid. He's like, no, stupid, you need to do blah, blah, blah. Like, he obviously didn't get hired.
Even when people use chatbots conscientiously, they make it so easy to, say, apply to 1,000 jobs at once, it can be harder to narrow down candidates, says Thomas Vick at HR consulting firm Robert Half. And some employers have added extra steps to verify applicants' skills in real time.
Like for IT, for example, having the people they're interviewing whiteboard and actually explain to them how they're doing something.
Solving hiring challenges exacerbated by AI will likely involve more AI, says Joseph Fuller, a professor at Harvard Business School.
You do get this kind of spy versus spy in a war.
Many companies already use algorithmic applicant tracking systems to filter resumes. Marketplace's parent company, American Public Media Group, uses one, UKG. And Fuller says employers are starting to use chatbot interviews or automated skills and personality assessments. These AI tools can make the hiring process more objective and efficient, but
it tends to work against somebody who's an outlier in any regard.
Like a veteran journalist who might actually make a really great wine taster? Come on, I'll have my bot call your bot. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
You might have seen the news yesterday that the White House is making a big push on supply chains. There's going to be a cabinet-level supply chain council. There's going to be formal reviews of how things move around in this economy as well. By and large, though, supply chains are working pretty well right now, by and large. For one big chunk of the American economy, more than $600 billion a year big, things aren't great. The long arms of the pandemic are still holding on tight to the chemical industry, as Marketplace's Sabri Benishor reports.
10% of all U.S. exports of goods are chemicals. It's an industry that covers a whole lot of ground, from plastics to pills.
Literally tens of thousands of different products.
Martha Moore is chief economist at the American Chemistry Council.
Things like plastic resins, chemicals that go into a variety of products, fertilizers, consumer products, so things like dish soap and shampoo.
During the pandemic, demand surged for chemicals used to make the fibers in masks and PPE, chemicals to just make stuff in general that we were ordering, and people had time to do a lot of things, like home improvement, that used a lot of chemicals, plastics, varnishes. But in a way, all that demand back then was borrowing from demand today. And in the second half of last year, it all came crashing down. Chuck Venezia is Senior Vice President of Chemical Markets at Argus.
The prices of some of the key commodity plastics, things to make pipes and buckets and housewares and things like that, dropped 50 to 60%.
Meanwhile, the price of oil used to make the building blocks of many chemicals did not come crashing down.
So the margins in the chemical industry really came to a screeching halt, and we've been bouncing along the bottom since then.
But one of the big issues has been something that much of the rest of the economy has tried to put behind it. David Yankovitz leads the chemical practice at Deloitte.
We're really seeing unprecedented levels of destocking.
Destocking, getting through extra inventory, not buying more stuff because you already have too much on the shelves and in the warehouse. This is what retailers like Target were complaining about last year. It has taken time for that to cascade back up the supply chain.
There's a lot of steps that need to destock along the way. And, you know, ultimately, the chemical industry, if you will, is the last stop.
On the bright side, economists say the worst may well be over, and there are big opportunities on the horizon. As the U.S. moves to greener energy, it'll need chemicals to do it. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishor for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, a guy who didn't get quite as much press as his business partner, but was just as instrumental to the growth of their company. Berkshire Hathaway announced this afternoon that Charlie Munger has died. Munger was 99, and for 60 of those years, he was at Warren Buffett's side as they built Berkshire Hathaway into the conglomerate it is today. All right, we got to go. Here is your moment of economic context. It's more curiosity, really. One share of Class A Berkshire Hathaway stock at the close today, the stock that Munger and Buffett famously never split, down 0.1% to $546,869 apiece. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Dylan Mieten, and Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Ellen Rolfes, Virginia K. Smith, and Tony Wagner. Francesca Levy is the executive director of digital and on-demand. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.